famous
my,
one.
My first prediction for next year then is going to be Lake Erie continues to be full of water.
Well, a very happy Winterville, or whatever we decide to call it, to all of you, and Merry Xmas to the ones who don't care. This is Bad Voltage, Festivus. This is episode 57, and it is the very end of the year. Very end of 2015.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. And we sadly, it's only the three of us today, because Brian's off, because he claims that he's sick, whereas long-time listeners of the show will know that that's complete lies and nonsense, and that he's just, you know, watching TV or something.
In his defense, he says he doesn't have a voice, which, yeah, because he's got some kind of a cold or something.
Important.
And he's completely lost
his voice.
He did
mention that he was on the way to urgent care, so I would go under the presumption that
he's on his way to urgent care.
That's what he said.
This is the point, Captain Mockery. He might actually be quiet.
Well, that's probably a lie as well.
So Brian's lost his voice, which, if you could hear over the resounding sounds of cheers from A, us, and B, his family. We hope he gets better soon. Good luck, Brian.
And I also, for those of you who may have picked up on it, I also have a bit of a cold as well. So I'm going to try not to sniff and cough all the way through it, because I know that annoys some of you. But in the theme of lies and misinformation, what are we going to start the show out with, Jeremy?
The sound engineer of the group doesn't have a cough button. I find that very surprising, actually.
Yeah.
So we're going to, one of the segments we're going to have this episode is, we're going to go over the predictions that we all made last year about what would happen in 2015 and find out just how spectacularly poorly we predict the future.
Shock, horror. We're also going to get into a suggestion that was sent in to us by Greg Lowe. Thank you, Greg. About the blockchain and a recent Linux Foundation announcement about a big collaboration going on around defining blockchains and how we operate them.
And while we had a quite, in my mind, interesting review lined up, because Brian didn't have a voice, he can't do his Pixel C review, but I would anticipate that being in a future show. But instead, Ak came in and saved the day in the last minute, and he's going to review the Fused Chicken Titan, a cable made of titanium, unobtainium, and steel.
And finally, we're going to talk about the Software Freedom Conservancy and the Linux Foundation again in our special Linux Foundation-only show, as far as I can tell. So there's the SFC, the Linux Foundation VMware, in what's been described as a love triangle, but it's not clear there's any love.
And before we start the show, I mentioned last week that I hadn't listened to the show that I wasn't in, and I would like to concur with your assessment, Ak. It was almost indistinguishable from when I do it. Almost. And now, Bad Voltage. So as this is the last episode of Bad Voltage for 2015, and as sad as that is, the show will go on in 2016, so don't get too sad.
Yes, it will.
But at the end of last year, if you remember, if you're a regular listener, we broke up into two segments, our predictions for the year 2015. So as a last show, it's probably a good time to look back at those predictions and see just how incorrect we were. Now, you remember last year, I kind of curb-stomped you guys in this one and did quite a bit better. So I upped mine, so we'll see how we all did this year. My hopes going into this are not high.
No, I don't think any of us are particularly confident about this. Should we start with Mr. Langridge first?
Yeah, go on then. This is not a bright spot in my life as a, you know, as a pundit. I got to tell you, but go on.
So yeah, so we each picked two predictions, and then I'm not sure if all of us had bonus.
We all had bonus ones as well.
Oh, we did. Okay, brilliant. Okay, so Stuart Langridge's first prediction was that $2 billion of stuff sold with NFC payments would happen from phones. So how did you get on there?
Well, having
and the hilarious thing about this, just to go back a little bit for 1 second, you wanted to do a billion, and we mercilessly shamed you into going all the way to
That's
2.
That's right.
So what was the actual number?
Well, it's a bit difficult to get sales figures for this. You will hear the language whine, it's a bit difficult to get sales figures for this, a number of times during this segment. This is only the first occurrence.
It is.
But according to FMI, total amount of mobile payments is $549 billion in 2015. An NFC transaction, so literally just wave your phone at the thing, which was the point of my prediction, was 8.3% of that. So I predicted $2 billion. The actual answer is $45 billion.
So, and the funny thing is, and this is an actual quote from you. We tried to harass you. I think it was Brian mockingly said, let's amp it to 10. And your quote is, $10 billion is an awful lot of money. Not going to happen.
If you were looking to be picky, I was shamed into double my original prediction, and it was still 1.5 orders of magnitude away from the truth. So I'm not great at this, I must admit it. So yeah, one failure for me, nil point.
Well, on that note, let's continue the theme. Steam machines, this is the second prediction, steam machines will outsell consoles over the same given time period, such as the first Steam month. Steam machines outsell consoles for their first month. Now, I seem to remember that we mocked you on this one as well.
You did, in fact.
And I believe we would say with good reason. So how did you get on with this one?
I think anyone who has looked at the world of Steam machines and their release in mid-November 2015 will have seen that the sales figures appear to be nothing to write home about. Now, there aren't any actual published sales figures that I can find. I must admit, I could be wrong about this. If Alienware or Valve or someone like that stood up and gave real figures, you might find I'm wildly wrong, and there's a shed load of people out there who bought Steam machines and have been very, very quiet about it. But
I suspect that's
we are only 6 weeks. It's only been 6 weeks since the initial release of sales of Steam machines at all. They're mid-November,
right.
So we haven't got anything.
But that means they
like
came out at almost
quarter.
The perfect time to sell well, because it's that pre-Christmas rush, and I still don't hear anything about.
Yes, you would think that would happen. Now, PS4s currently sell about 800,000 a week. The Xbox One about 400,000 a week. It is, I suppose, technically possible that the Steam machines are selling 1 million a week and nobody's mentioned it, but I consider this vanishingly unlikely to actually be the case. So,
and the thing is, PS4s are selling 800,000 a week
now,
and they've already been out for a long time.
On release day now. So yes, I grant the point that we don't know what the sales of Steam machines are, but they're clearly some kind of appallingly damp squib. Otherwise, they'd be written somewhere. So epic failure for me, numero deux.
So that's two failed predictions. Two predictions, both failed.
I wouldn't get too smug if I was you, Baconio. I've seen the rest of the list. Carry on.
Let's now go on to the bonus prediction, which is very simple, that somebody will buy Canonical.
A division or the entire company.
Yep.
Both wrong.
The answer is equally simple. No, they didn't. So there
now
you go.
Now, to be fair, there's been some rumblings going on that this may be in the works.
But
amount of rumblings has accelerated in the last 6 weeks or so.
Yeah,
close.
Yeah,
no, big no-no. I'm more than happy for that to be a big no-no on my front. So I score a grand total of naught on my predictions. So much for being Cassandra. I'm rubbish. Next.
All right.
So now we'll move on to Jono's prediction. Now, if you listen to that episode, you will remember that Jono was roundly mocked for making not really as much as predictions, just statements of fact that were already currently happening. So his first one was transition from cable and satellite to Roku and general online services will accelerate, and there'll be a 10% drop in purchase renewal of cable and satellite services because people are moving to internet-provided movie and TV services. Now, the funny thing is, I tried to give him credit for this, and the article that he linked to was an article from March of 2015 talking about Q3 and Q4 of 2014.
Yeah.
And there was over a 10% drop in 2014. So basically what you predicted is that the future is going to be the same as the last 6 months. And in fact, it kind of decelerated. So you were, you didn't predict anything, A, and B, still were kind of wrong somehow.
Well, so I have to say, I looked at this document and Ack had already gone and done a bunch of the data, so I haven't gone and dug into it myself. But I would, without data at hand, I would say that the spirit of that prediction is absolutely the case, is that more and more people are moving over to online services, not just in the US, but also in Europe as well, and then move into Roku or other types of online.
But I think mildly surprisingly, it did not accelerate in 2015 in any meaningful way, and seems like it almost decelerated very slightly, which was a shock to me too.
2015, I would be surprised if that's the case. I'd be surprised if it didn't accelerate.
It's jolly hard, again, right? Standard whinge, number one, hard to find sales figures, which it is. And yes, the thing I found was an article from March, and I thought it was talking about quarter one of 2015. And they specifically said, this is the cable companies themselves complaining that all their customers are moving to Netflix or what have you, and total TV viewing had dropped 10%. But that was last year, before you made the prediction.
I thought, honestly, with HBO Now and ESPN and all those services coming out, that it would rapidly accelerate, which was, I think, the spirit of your prediction.
Yeah.
And that really did not. I think cable companies in 2015, for the first time ever, acknowledged it was an issue and started having bigger promotions and actually tried to start fighting it. Where in 2014, I think they ignored it a lot more, which might be why it didn't accelerate as much as we all thought.
Yeah, so I think it certainly hasn't got any worse. Basically, there's been a gradual, maybe 10% a year or so, shift away from cable and satellite services towards internet, broadband delivered services. That is the case, and you did predict that, but it was already happening, and it hasn't got any worse. So whether that we count that as a pass or a fail, I don't know.
Well, to be fair, we don't have data. So this may be happening. We just don't know about it.
I actually looked into the numbers fairly closely. There's a decent Business Insider that has kind of numbers. And then there's a couple of companies. Time Warner, if you believe them, actually didn't even lose subscribers. I don't know.
What?
Bullshit.
That's what they claim. Which, that's what I said. Although who knows how they measure that number. Accounting departments always find creative ways to get whatever number they want. So there's no data into what the number is.
Right. All right, so we have, I guess we have,
at the time, what was considered a super safe prediction.
Yeah.
I remember the bollocking that I got about it being safe, and it was a fair bollocking.
I'm prepared to give you half a point for it.
So it sounds like for this one, it's kind of, maybe?
Do we give him half a point, Jezza?
Come on, Jared.
I would give him a half a point.
Takes the hard line.
I would give him a half a point in total if you take both of us together.
We'll
move on to the second one. This will be, quote unquote, the year of 4K. At least 6, probably closer to 10, sub 500 4K TVs, largely ushering in the era of 4K. This was unequivocally not the year of 4K. First of all, there's almost no more content than there was a year ago. And while Eck found a couple of sub-$500 TVs on Google Shopping, they're all from no-name manufacturers, and they're all like TVs that are the size of a laptop.
Doesn't matter. That's still within the prediction.
And this is another one, going back to how your predictions were not predictions. When you predicted this last year, Eck pointed out they were already available sub-$500 in 2014.
Well, there was a couple. I would argue. So first of all, the point about content is absolutely fair. There is basically no more 4K content. I mean, you can get it, but you can get it on those really stupid, expensive hard disks that audio video lunatics get. I remember on Black Friday this year, there was a considerable number of 4K TVs, because I looked into it and then I thought, oh, I should write this down, and then didn't write it down. So I would say that there are a significant number additional number of 4K TVs. But and yes, they are no-name things, but that's how it all starts, to be fair.
I still think the spirit of what you were predicting totally didn't happen.
Yeah, no,
I admit that that's a technicality.
Yeah, you probably passed this by the letter of the law. Yes, it's true that if you've only got $500, you want a 4K television, you can find some to buy. You could even find a couple by companies you've heard of, like LG. But the reason I looked at Best Buy is that that's where someone's going to walk in off the street and buy a thing, right? And they have no 4K televisions for under $500. Well, they're all $900.
To be fair, my prediction specifically...
Amazon didn't have any either.
My prediction specifically was at least 6, probably close to 10.
But if Amazon and Best Buy together have none... That is in effect none. That Google Shopping on some weird site that's probably going to steal your credit card has them.
Google Shopping, can you go somewhere on the internet and buy a 4K TV for less than $500? If you can get them on Google Shopping, then it passes.
Well, right, I'm sure you can go somewhere on the internet and buy a kidney. That doesn't say much.
No, but that's a weird bar. The point is, I didn't say that it was on Amazon. I didn't say that it was on Best Buy.
If you take Amazon and Best Buy together, that's the average person. But I'll give you half in total.
Yeah, this is why I marked it as a pass. It's very much a technical pass. It passes
the letter
of the rule and not the spirit. Because the spirit is everyone will be buying 4K TVs, and the answer is no one is buying 4K TVs.
So let me ask you this. I do not have a 4K TV. Jono, do you? Just out of curiosity.
But to be honest, we bought our TV like 8 years ago.
My TV's quite old.
So I'd say with the first prediction, there just isn't data. And I think half a point is probably generous, and that's not, and I appreciate that. But I'd say with the second one, it did pass. If you can find it on Google Shopping, it did pass. It is, I admit, a technicality, and I'm holding your feet to the fire on a technicality, but I'm not into this for fairness. I'm in this for winning, because I got a round bollocking when we did this, and I want to win. And so far, I'm winning. All right? We haven't got to Jeremy yet, and that's so where I'll it tell probably you what, goes downhill. Right? But
I'll do you a deal, Baconio. I'd be prepared to give you half a point for each of those predictions, which gives you 1 point in total.
No!
Hang on. Right?
All right.
But if you draw with someone else, if someone else gets 1 point in total, then you get to win. So you've got 1.0001 points or something.
What? That I did not understand a word of that.
The idea
The point is...
He's saying you have one point, but you have the kicker.
Yeah, you've got 1 point and the kicker.
The point is, though, is that you can go onto the internet now and buy more than 6 4K TVs for less than $500. That was the prediction. The fact that you guys don't like the fact that I'm winning should have nothing to do with it. This is discrimination,
We should have made the win condition, I guess, more unambiguous.
Well, that's on you guys.
No, I suppose, technically, he predicted that.
I did
that.
Technically, Pat.
Right, okay, but in that case, so what, I'm withdrawing my kindness about number one, and you get no points for that because it failed. So, you get one point in total.
Well, but that's not fair because with the previous one, we can't say the previous one failed because we don't have the data.
I still think that wasn't even a prediction, though. It was just like exact current market trends will continue.
Hey. It's not my fault that I picked a prediction that was possibly easy and ambiguous to define, okay? I think that's 1.5 points. Let's move on to the bonus one.
My first prediction for next year then is going to be Lake Erie continues to be full of water. move on to the bonus.
The sun will rise somewhere in between 300 and 400 times this year.
Right, yes.
If you can get it past that, and also I'd say in the spirit of that one, of the cable satellite one, we're definitely seeing more and more people moving away from cable to digital services. We just don't have the data on it. So you guys,
I still don't think 15 was. If we look back, I don't think 15 will be anywhere near an inflection point.
Yeah, that's a fair point, all. I think.
Maybe.
Right,
maybe.
Bonus prediction for
right, so bonus. Anyway,
we should move on.
The connected home is the next big area of tech interest. Lots of major companies offering connected home devices, more and more people setting up Internet of Things devices in their home, Nest, but applied to everything. The market will double, was $10 billion in 2014, so expecting $20 billion in 2015. If prediction is too low, then the prediction fails.
Right.
So, interestingly, ACK put market did not anything like double, went up by 20%. All the numbers that I see say that it way, way, way over doubled and you undershot it.
Oh, okay. I mean, this is something where it's difficult to... you talk about the connected home, and exactly what that includes is wildly open to guesswork.
See, that is very difficult.
So I found a bunch of
graphs. The number I saw was 61 billion.
Right, see, I saw a bunch of graphs showing steady but not egregious growth of around 20% per year, last year and this year. But you're seeing huge things. I think, depending on how you answer this question, it either isn't very much or it's loads, but it's either way above Jono's prediction or way below it, and either way, no points.
Correct.
Which is unfortunate.
So basically, like with your prediction, Ak, we were just too right.
Yeah.
I mean, with basically there is ultra-right, right, maybe, and fail.
I think...
So, yeah.
Yeah. You were either too splashy or too conservative. I'm sure if you went out looking around for results, you could probably find some arbitrarily chosen subset of the connected home which doubled and then claim victory. But I don't think it's the thing to do here.
No. Right. Well, so...
I'd say you do have one, which is one more than zero, which is what Stuart's
currently saying. Well, one and a half because no data is available.
And Brian's comment on this was all of these failed to happen. The era of 4K is not here. There are minor amounts of content. Big no.
I was going to say, I suspect if Brian was here, he might be arguing for you to have zero. So
and that's why it's really good that he's not here. So let's move on to Jeremy's. Okay,
yes.
Jeremy said that 2015 will be the first year in many years that both laptop and desktop sales will be higher than the previous year. And it appears that that is a big...
This was a reach. So it actually turns out laptop sales for the first time did actually go up, but desktop sales definitely went down. They went down at a decelerating rate, but they still very much went down. So I can't...
Yeah, again, a lot of this depends
on... The spirit
of
mine was correct in that I think that was probably a aberrant year. So I kind of got the spirit of it, but I definitely didn't hit the letter of it.
But haven't desktop sales been declining for the last God knows how many years now?
Yes.
Yeah, it was seven in a row. That's why I was saying they wouldn't decline.
Yeah, that was the point of the prediction, that instead of continuing
the standard... Well, desktop and laptop sales would go up.
You didn't say that they wouldn't decline. You said that they'd be higher.
Correct. And so laptop sales were higher, but desktop sales, right, while they declined at a decelerating rate, did not accelerate.
Yeah.
Right.
And again, a lot of this depends on who you ask for figures. I mean, looking at IDC, it looks like there's been a 10% drop or so over the course of the year, but it's difficult to know exactly what they're counting in that.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So that's a big fat fail then.
That is.
All right, I just want to make sure we're clear on this. All right, so the next one. The growth of devices capable of wireless charging. All major phone manufacturers except Apple, so that's going to be Samsung, HTC, Motorola, etc., will ship wireless charge capable phones, their flagship models, without special backplates. So you'd have to go and buy special things to do wireless charging. And that cafes, airports, and etc. will offer wireless charging points. And we'll see wireless charging appear in keyboards, other devices, and etc. You started out good with this one.
I should be clear. The major part of this prediction was the phones with wireless charging. Comrade Garcia chucked in, and you'll be able to charge them all over the place, and keyboards
and
will do it. And
I think Starbucks has it in some places now, and there's a couple airports. I kind of got the letter of this one right, the spirit of it didn't, and I'll tell you why. I failed to understand how good USB-C and quick charging would be.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think that's the thing. I mean, certainly the major part of the prediction did pass. I've gone and looked, and every major phone manufacturer, Samsung, Xiaomi, HTC, whoever,
I even hit the except Apple.
Yeah, they all have wireless charging built in to at least one proper phone in their range. And right, most of them multiple phones. So it's getting there. But what we've not seen is the spirit of the prediction, which was that everyone just be wireless and it'll be wireless stuff all over. I've not been in a Starbucks here that has it, as an example. And I've looked.
And there wasn't a wireless charging thing in Hong Kong Airport,
which you think would be, you know, number one for technology. Because I looked for it.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually surprised about that one.
I was too.
Yeah. I know the Starbucks in New York have it. Jono just said the Starbucks in California do as well.
Yeah, yeah. We're definitely seeing them cropping up more and more.
Right.
I'd liken this kind of in a similar way to 4K televisions.
Yeah, and people buying Canonical. It might happen next year, but it didn't happen this year. But yeah, I think Jeremy's point about how USB-C is going to be brilliant and you can charge things really, really quickly is a very good one.
The fact that with the Nexus 6P you can charge it in something around 40%-ish in 10 minutes is, you don't need wireless charging.
I mean, when I got my Samsung Galaxy S5, and you plug that in with their high-capacity charger thing, it's done in about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it really is impressive.
Yeah, but I mean, quite clearly, the wireless charging thing is the way of the future. I mean, everybody's going to have them on their bedside tables and you'll be able to plug stuff in. So it just seems like you're probably a little bit early. So, bonus. NASDAQ will break its... Oh, yeah, two bonuses. NASDAQ will break its all-time record, intraday high of 51.32, or all-time high close of 50.48. And also, at some point in 2015, things will go very, very badly, and there will be a serious correction and over 10% drop in a short amount of time.
So, I definitely nailed that one. There was a correction in August, and it hit both highs.
Yeah, this is true. Hit the all-time high close, or it beat the all-time high close, which is now 50.73. And I thought there wasn't a serious correction, but I've been corrected and there was. So that's a pass. Big tick for Jezza.
I have no idea what any of you guys are talking about, I trust your judgment.
I had to learn a whole bunch about market microstructure to understand the graphs. It's really annoying.
What I do understand is the
epic
second
fail
bonus,
too,
which is that Uber will IPO.
See, none of this intraday high 51.32 bollocks. Nice, easy ones to have prediction. Uber will IPO. Nice, easy ones to have answer. No, they didn't. No points.
Mind you, and again, to be fair to Jeremy, it's quite obvious they're gonna IPO. Just wouldn't surprise me actually. Wouldn't surprise me actually if it's early next year that we'll see that.
Ideally, so overall, it would be on January 2nd, just for sheer lulls.
So what's the score now? So that got 0. I got 1.5.
Jeremy, I think, has got 2.
I think Jeremy's got 2, because, Jeremy's got 2. So
Brian.
Which is annoying me, I'll be honest.
Okay.
All right, Brian.
Especially because you guys mocked me for making ridiculous out there predictions, and we mocked you for making very easy predictions.
Yeah.
Well, I think this quite clearly determines Brian, who's good at predictions and who isn't.
Brian could take the cake here, so let's see. His first one was the antithesis of one of Ack's predictions in that Steam boxes will not ship a single device in 2015. And they did ship multiple Steam devices.
Yeah, so that's an easy one. I love the fact that the Bad Voltage team was just outright wrong about Steam boxes.
Well, there was a funny thing at the end of this segment. Someone said, at least one of us is going to be right. And I think it was Ack that pointed out, like, no, it could be wrong. They could ship and just not sell well. And that is exactly what happened.
And I'm sure that I haven't listened to that segment, but I'm sure that when we said it, we're like, like that's really going to happen. But it did happen.
We totally nailed what actually happened in that stupid throwaway comment, which is very irritating. But yes, they did ship, they didn't sell well. We both lose our Steam predictions. That's terrible. Next.
So Brian failed. And obviously Brian can't be here to defend himself. So at this point, I'd just like to make it quite clear that Brian's got a stupid haircut. So what was the second one?
Brian's second prediction was that Ubuntu phones will ship, but they'll sell less than 50% the amount of any competing phone. And we include Yola phones, Firefox OS phones in here. And he went further and said, you can compare the highest selling month of Ubuntu phone sales, compare that with the lowest selling month of Yola or Firefox phone sales, and Ubuntu will be less than half of that competition. Now, standard whinge, hard to get sales figures. Even the sales figures you can get are all very kind of weird and predicted off of things like the order numbers that you get from websites and so on. So they're all quite dodgy.
Yeah.
And they're certainly not broken down by month. But as far as I can tell, Yola phones have probably sold about 40,000 or so. Ubuntu phones have sold about 30,000 or so. Neither of those two figures are up to date all the way up to today. to December. But Yola laid off half their staff and nearly went bankrupt. It strikes me this has not happened if they've just sold a million phones, right? Firefox have basically stepped away from selling Firefox OS phones through carriers. So again, you would think if they'd sold half a million phones, that wouldn't have happened. So my belief here is that this prediction is a failure. If someone has amazing Yola sales figures from somewhere, they're welcome to speak up, at which point Brian can retroactively get the point. But I really don't think this is a pass.
I have to say, in Brian's defense, the fact that we don't have data for Firefox OS is a major issue here, because first of all, I'd be very surprised if Yola sold 40,000 phones.
I think they might have sold 40,000 devices, but their best selling device was a tablet, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, that's a good point.
I thought the tablet wasn't out.
Oh. The tablet wasn't out because don't follow Yola too closely.
That's what everyone was complaining about. That when they said, oh no, we're probably going to fail and we've laid off half the staff, everyone's like, we paid for a damn tablet on Kickstarter or Indiegogo. Where is it? But there may be two tablets. I'm not sure myself.
I just feel that we're fairly plugged in, given the fact that we don't have data, we're fairly plugged into the technology world and the kind of people who are going to buy Yola phones. I don't see anyone talking about owning them or having them. Totally observational data. I'd be very surprised if they saw that many. Ubuntu phones, 30,000 sounds about right to me. Wouldn't surprise me at all. Which is not many, given the fact that there's obviously a billion Ubuntu users, according to Dustin Kirkland.
Never seen such.
We should get him on the show to talk about that, because Dustin's solid gold. But I'm almost, again, no data. This is just a guess. I would guess that that Mozilla sold at least 100,000 Firefox phones last year. I just think they're dealing in different levels or different orders of magnitude than either Ubuntu or Yola. And the fact that they shut that down, I suspect, is more...
But the spirit of it is that Firefox and or Yola would do very well, and one is not even a product anymore, and the other one almost declared bankruptcy.
I'm guessing that the reason why Mozilla are shutting Firefox down is because I think their goals for that project are way higher than realistic goals. First of all, I think they're probably more realistic about their goals than Canonical, and secondly, I think their goals are probably a lot higher. The fact that they went out the gate with that many carriers suggests that they were running a much bigger game. So I would have guessed that they would have probably sold a lot more devices, but it's not meeting the overall kind of goals that they've got.
I had great difficulty attempting to find figures for this, but
yeah.
I think based on that, I think the spirit of Brian's prediction was Ubuntu will flop and alternative open source non-Android phones would not flop.
And that didn't happen.
To the extent that Ubuntu flopped,
to be fair, Brian commented on his predictions, and his exact quote was, "I will go on record as monumentally failing in all my predictions." So I don't think he's trying to take credit for it.
All right. Well, it's done then. He failed. All right. So Brian had a bonus, which is that Chrome OS will run all Android apps and have the full Google Play Store. And it seems like this is a sorter, right? Because you can run some apps, but you still have to install Arc and play around, and many apps aren't supported.
And you haven't got the Play Store, which is the important thing. That I think, again, the spirit of this prediction was that you'd have a Chromebook and it would just show you the Play Store and you could pick anything from it just like you can on an Android phone. And that did not happen. Arc allows you to run Android apps. They don't all run, but a lot of them do. But it's still very much an I'll install Arc, I'll bring the app across. You're not getting a consumer-friendly one-click install an app from the App Store like you are on phones. So it depends on exactly how you read the thing, but it doesn't have the full Play Store as Brian. I mean, as Joey said, Brian commented that he failed in all his stuff. Steambox is shipped, but nobody noticed. Ubuntu phones sold, but not in North America, not in big numbers. Chromos didn't get the Play Store.
Brian basically failed on all of his predictions.
I'm a bit disappointed by all of Canonical, Google, and Valve for not doing a cool thing, right?
Yeah, this year was a bit crappy in that. I mean, I've said this before. I admire Canonical for what they've accomplished with the Ubuntu phone because it's, given the size of the team. But at the end of the day, that doesn't matter in the scheme of things if it's not being successful in the market.
You don't get points for effort, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. Like, while I emotionally admire them for what they've done. And I'd say the same thing for Mozilla and for Yola, to be fair. It's not just Canonical. It doesn't matter unless people can actually get their hands on one and it actually works very well. So Brian failed on all of his. I guess the final scores then are Ack, 0. Jeremy, 2. Me, 1.5. Brian, 0.
So
Jeremy's
Jezza
quite
wins.
Clearly the winner.
Score.
Jezza wins again.
Good
very
work,
good.
Jeremy.
Although possibly again. Only because he did some kind of complicated economist's prediction about the NASDAQ, which no one else understood. So.
That is fair. The fact that we don't really understand what that meant.
I will have to up my game. I will have to up my game for next episode where we'll do the 2016 predictions and see what happens.
My next prediction is clearly going to be a very, very technical sound engineering related prediction. Yeah, cool. So let us know what you thought about these predictions, folks. Go to community.badvoltage.org and maybe start sharing your predictions for what you want to see in 2016.
Every third newspaper article these days about the technology world and predicting things that are going to happen talks about the blockchain, which is the technology underlying Bitcoin, right? I'm not sure whether it was actually invented for Bitcoin or whether the concept was around before, but we're seeing the concept of the blockchain get bandied about as the underlying structure for a whole bunch of new proposed stuff. The Linux Foundation recently put together a project to advance blockchain technology. A chap called Greg Lowe emailed the show and pointed this out to us and said, just come across the news that this had happened. And what happened was on December the 17th, the Linux Foundation announced a new collaborative effort to advance the popular blockchain technology. And they've got a whole bunch of really interesting names on the list. You know, I mean, you've got technology companies like Cisco and VMware and Fujitsu, but you've also got financial companies, Accenture, ANZ, JP Morgan, the London Stock Exchange, Deutsche Börse, that kind of thing. So the question here becomes, is the idea of the blockchain actually going to be fundamental, or is this just a bunch of people sitting back going, wouldn't it be great if this could happen and then no actual products will come out of it?
I'd be very surprised if those companies signed up. And if you looked at the press release as well, they didn't just, you know, you get a lot of these companies who sign up to you know, collaborative kind of work. But it's very kind of ambiguous about what they're actually going to do. But in that press announcement, it actually I don't have it in front of me. Maybe you can read it out, Ack, if you got it there. But it actually said what some of these companies were actually contributing to it. So they were quite specific in how that's operating. And, you know, one of the things, the Linux Foundation has turned into the place in the open source world where this kind of stuff tends to happen. They've got Jim Zemlin and co. have got a remarkable talent of bringing together people from a wide variety of companies and getting them to work on stuff. And we've seen that with things like Open Daylight and various other projects. So, you know, I think they will actually spit something out. Whether this is the right thing, whether this is going to actually have an impact on the world, I don't know. I just don't know enough about the blockchain, to be honest with you.
I mean, it's interesting because there's a startup, right, called Receive that is basically they call it the Distributed Ledger Initiative, but it's really Blockchain Initiative. And they already have 42 member banks, and these aren't small banks, right? This is Bank of America, Citi, Deutsche, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, RBS. I mean, it's basically all the big ones are involved in Receive. Ripple's been doing this for a while. There are quite a bit of banking companies, especially, you know, fintech companies, for lack of a better term, that are already doing this kind of stuff. And you have Overstock has a subsidiary called T0, and they're actually they already got approval from the SEC to issue their securities over the Bitcoin blockchain. But the Linux Foundation Initiative and Receive and Ripple are kind of private blockchains, not based on Bitcoin. In the case of Receive, it's going to be completely private. I'm not sure what I think the Linux Foundation just wants enterprise grade open source software is how the press release was written.
So I'm guessing though that this is, and again, I've read into the blockchain. There's chunks of it that I don't quite understand, but the notion of a blockchain database is not specifically tied into Bitcoin.
No.
So it sounds like the principle of a blockchain that has, you know, that with open source tools and standards and protocols is what the LF thing is focused on.
Yes.
Whereas it sounds like maybe some of these other companies are not focusing on that. So, because the Linux Foundation are doing this with like networking, and they're doing this with various other areas, like things like software defined networking, is where we're starting to see some of these kind of collaborations around this, which in my mind seems like a great idea. If this is going to have a significant impact on the industry, and particularly on the financial services markets, then it seems good that we get that going at the beginning as a series of open source projects.
It's going to be interesting to see how it progresses too. Stuart doesn't think so from the sound of it.
there's a lot of talk from, as John mentioned in the press release from the LF, they've got comments from a whole bunch of the companies involved, Deutsche Börse or Cisco or Fujitsu or whatever. And there's a lot of comments like distributed ledger technology is quickly becoming the most exciting industry to help build out and so on, right? But I think there's a number of steps here. The first one is the idea of a distributed ledger, and this is going to be a whole bunch of companies getting together and basically rigorously specifying a way to have a distributed ledger based on a blockchain, a shared blockchain into which everything is logged. And that will be possibly good, and possibly it'll turn into some industry-defined nightmare like SOAP did for communicating data via XML or whatever, but okay. The second question then is, there are also a bunch of people referring to it as the Open Ledger project, but it's not at all clear to me that this data will actually be open. Part of the nice thing about Bitcoin is not just that there's a shared blockchain, but that anyone can see it.
Ripple and Receive, it's explicitly you cannot see it. It's a private blockchain.
This is the thing, you know. I mean, so there is part of the nice concept with Bitcoin is that anyone can verify any transaction by looking at the public blockchain. Whereas with this, to be honest with you, if a whole bunch of banks are using a blockchain to share their data amongst themselves and it's not public, who cares? The thing which makes this be interesting.
Who cares is everyone, in that instead of it taking, if I send you money right now, in 2015, almost 2016, you won't get it for days because it's an international money transfer. The whole point of the blockchain would be, because both sides are instantly verifiable, you should get that money in minutes at no cost. There'll be no clearinghouse. So that's the point of the blockchain, if it was implemented in the way that they're saying, would be that you could immediately trust all transactions because you would know the genesis of each block. So right now the banks have to trust the other people.
But banks can, for instance, here in the UK, you can do faster payments. So you make a payment and it says this is being sent as a faster payment, and then it takes effect in minutes. So we can all do that. I admit it's a bit more problematic internationally, and maybe moving to blockchain will help with this. But it's not clear to me that moving to using blockchain technology is required for that faster payment stuff to happen. You know, and all the other
it's probably evolutionary, the technology that makes the most sense for it, and B, because they can get rid of the clearinghouses, there'll be less fees for them associated with it.
Bitcoin has, I guess you could say, disrupted technology.
What does disrupted
ways,
mean?
Right? It means fucked up. Have you shared that with our listeners, by the way, your theory?
I think, didn't we talk about it in the last show?
I think we did. So, one thing is cryptocurrencies, and then, of course, there's the blockchain piece as well, which doesn't have to be necessarily used for just Bitcoin. So, in my mind, if you have a new disruptive technology such as that, that if you've got, you know, the people who've signed onto this Linux Foundation thing are serious companies. And if we're going to start building out a technology like that, to do that in an open source manner, even if the actual blockchain itself is not necessarily open, in my mind is a step in the right direction.
I think when they say open, they mean the software that the blockchain is built on is open, not the data within the chain is open. That's not even that, I think.
I didn't bring up SOAP earlier idly, right? That was a big industry collaboration on how to exchange data. And then you got an open standard for what SOAP should look like. But it didn't actually make it any easier for anyone to work with data, because banks didn't, for instance, provide APIs which allowed you access to their data, whether using SOAP or not. And if there's a whole bunch of big companies here getting together to make it easy to transfer money between banks, I get a second order effect benefit, which is that I transfer money to Germany, it arrives 15 minutes later. But what I actually want, the whole point of having this stuff built on open technologies, is so people like us can get access to that data. And that requires the banks to go, okay, now we've got this blockchain, now we'll give you access to your portion of the transactions on it or whatever. So you can verify.
I don't necessarily.
I don't see there's any particular the case, benefit.
I would very much disagree with you that SOAP wasn't useful, though. I mean, if you remember the API infrastructure that existed before SOAP, SOAP was the first step in standardizing and realizing that this made sense and that SOAP itself, while it sucked, the concept behind it was legitimate. So we came up with REST, which doesn't suck, and now open APIs are everywhere. Without SOAP as the first step, I don't think any of that would have happened.
Yeah,
that's the point. I'm not worried about, yes, there are open APIs everywhere, but not in anyone's bank or anything to do with money or anything to do with fintech. What I want out of this is the ability to download a list of my transactions from my bank, right? And part
that
of the reason they say, oh, no, we're not going
to
do that now.
I don't think the blockchain would even make that easier.
What?
A blockchain wouldn't make that any easier.
Which is
your
why
bank
I'm
already
not
that
bothered about the technology. I don't care. If the banks could all get together and say, we're going to use one big shared Excel spreadsheet on Google Docs and it would make transfers happen instantly. I don't care what invisible under the covers technology they use. Why is that a benefit?
No, it wouldn't, because then you would have to trust, the banks would have to trust each other's numbers because they couldn't see where that dollar originated from and to make sure that it's still assigned to the correct person. The whole point of the blockchain is you can go all the way back to the Genesis chain. That's...
But
why
can't.
You can trust them.
You could do that with Bitcoin because all Bitcoins have been explicitly generated. You can't trace the dollar I've got back to the beginning because where the hell is the beginning?
Well, surely the fact that wouldn't, based upon that point, wouldn't that demand that the ledger is open, that the data is open?
The data is absolutely unequivocally, in the case of banks, not going to be open.
Yeah.
Ever.
This is my
well,
thing.
Yeah. But that's where I don't understand how this is going to work. Like, I get the fact that the Linux Foundation coming together to build tools around how this works and potentially developing standards around it. But what I don't understand is how the blockchain can operate in a world where you're dealing with dollars and not actually Bitcoin.
So their idea of a blockchain is not even tied to currency, right? They're talking about they're going to use it for supply chain management. They're going to use it for a whole bunch of things where money is not necessarily even part of the equation. So a lot of these blockchains aren't... So the Bitcoin blockchain specifically is a proof of work blockchain, but there are other kinds of blockchains where if you need a private key to sign every transaction, you might not need the proof of work piece, so you're going to use something else. So the private blockchains are not going to work exactly like the Bitcoin blockchain is. And I think it's interesting that the long-term thing that Bitcoin might give the world is kind of like Napster. Was cool when it was there and it came and went, but it really mainstream P2P. Bitcoin might always remain niche. It might not. That's difficult to ascertain at this point. But I think that its long-term thing might be that it gave the world blockchain.
Yeah, it gives the world the idea of the thing that they're describing, a shared distributed ledger, which is useful. As you
right,
say,
and the fact that it's immutable in the beginning,
stuff.
I think means you can do some interesting things with it. I think a lot of people now, they're... interpretation of what a blockchain is colored by the fact that it has to be the Bitcoin blockchain, and that's not necessarily the case if you believe Receive and Ripple in the Linux Foundation.
There are a bunch of other second order effects that come out of this. If you've got a whole bunch of companies pouring money into developing tools and standards and so on around the concept of a blockchain, it makes it easier for us to then say, okay, we're going to use blockchain technology to track who needs to do particular jobs on bad voltage, and there's already a bunch of tools built to help with that because they've built them.
Yeah,
and that's nice,
right?
And I would say the Linux Foundation is a good place as any to do that, because that's, like I said earlier on, that seems to be the place where people are tending to do this kind of stuff. And but it's like any foundation, if it's well run, it's well organized, we could actually see some really good stuff coming out of this. But if it isn't, then it will just be one of those failed starters like United Linux.
you would hope that the Linux Foundation would be a better place for this than them setting up the Distributed Blockchain Ledger Foundation or Consortium, which is all just a bunch of people in big businesses who don't share their information, don't go public, IP
that already exists. It's
everything.
Called Receive.
Right.
Right.
You
that
would
already
hope
exists.
That LF... imbue more of the openness we'd hope for into the process. I've got a bunch of USB cables for charging things. My flat's littered with them. Some came with phones or Kindles or speakers. Most of the now standard micro USB or some of that stupid old style mini USB trapezium shaped thing, which I keep around so half the crap in my laptop graveyard stays working. A couple of them are lightning cables for iPhones. And most of them are a bit frayed or bent or they've got dodgy connections because they've been run over by a chair or they've been screwed up in my pocket or I use them to tie a damsel to the railroad tracks or whatever. One company, Fuse Chicken, believe they've solved this problem and kindly sent us what they call Titan, the toughest cable on Earth. Apparently, it's the last cable you'll ever need because it's wrapped in flexible steel. According to them, you can chainsaw this cable and it won't be harmed. So if you need to charge your phone while you're in Leatherhead Cellar or something, this is clearly the place to go. I'll say this, when they call it tough, they are not kidding. I've dropped it off a balcony, I've had it run over by a car, I've played a game of tug of war with it, and it still doesn't have any problem charging. The box for undamageable cable is firmly ticked. It doesn't coil up very small because it's basically the same vibe as that huge flying snake thing from the end of the Avengers. You don't want to keep this in your coat pocket unless you also need a convenient way of hanging a car off the edge of a bridge while you're out in town. It comes in micro USB and lightning flavours, so it will charge any phone or device you've got lying around. The micro USB one is $25, the lightning one is $35, which on the one hand is 30 times the price of a bog standard cable, but on the other hand, foregoing 3 pints or a happy ending to your next massage to ensure you'll never have a frayed cable again sounds like a good idea to me. The bad voltage verdict? If your cables get frayed, get a Titan and they won't. Plus, it's nice and shiny.
So,
so many hilarious comments.
There is. Where do we?
So
even
it says the last cable you'll ever need. Correct.
Yep.
It's a mini USB.
A micro USB.
Or a micro USB, yeah, rather. You just got the HTC. You just got the. You just got a new phone.
Which has got ordinary micro USB on it. Yes.
And your
I'm
next
assuming
phone
they will bring
almost
out a
USB-C
have, version of this cable.
But then you'll need to buy
point.
A new Titan. So it is not, in any stretch of the imagination, the last cable you'll ever need.
Which, well, it seems to be, yeah, I mean, it seems...
B,
yeah.
What do you do
carry
to your
on,
cables? Because I am pretty rough on my stuff. And I don't buy... So by bog standard, you said they were like $3. I don't buy the cheapest. I'm of the mindset, if you buy anything from Aukey or Anker, it is a little bit more... But super high quality, always to spec, because now Google's actually buying stuff on Amazon and seeing if they're to spec, and yeah. Is almost indestructible. So I guess I don't chew on them or anything, but I'm pretty rough on stuff, and I do not have this problem with frayed cables.
I was going to say, like, based upon this company, Fuse Chicken, making these cables, what do they think people are doing to their cables?
I don't know. Because, I don't know. Think you'd be surprised. Right? I mean I've
cables,
got a bunch of
cables. Do get busted up.
I've got a bunch of cables which don't work right. You know, I mean, my iPhone cable frayed something terrible at the end. I mean, I don't know why that happened, but Neve's one did as well, which suggests that it's not just me. The micro USB cables I've got, some of them work better than others, and they all worked fine when I got them. And I'm forced to conclude that's because they've been bent about or they've broken inside or the connector's broken or something like that, right? And... yes, you might not want to go so far as to have a steel-sheathed cable which can't coil up and which costs $35. But if you're the sort of person who runs into problems with this sort of thing, this cable will never cause you a problem.
I can certainly see like industrial uses for this or certain applications where it makes a ton of sense. But
it just seems to me that they're not cheap by any stretch, right? I mean, it's not like we've got the whole stupid AV, you know, gold cables thing going on here. Like, a data cable is basically a data cable. What you're paying for is the fact that it's wrapped in this pretty tough material that means that you can't chainsaw it through or run it over in a car or whatever. But unless you're on Liam Neeson from Taken, I can't possibly think of a reason why you'd need this.
I think this is like, you know, the BlendTech people who do the Will It Blend videos? Right. No one is actually attempting to blend a brick, right? But if you buy something that
of the blender
can
is that
blend
it...
a brick, you know it's not going to get stuck on your frozen packet of kale. And this is the same principle, right? No one's actually trying to chainsaw their cable, but you know that if you coil the thing up inside your laptop bag and then drop your laptop bag, it's not going to break the fragile connections inside the connector.
But the point of the BlendTec thing is to demonstrate, like, one of the major functions of a blender is that it can blend stuff. And the point of those YouTube videos is that it shows that it'll blend anything. So you can put frozen fruit or whatever into it and it'll have absolutely no problem chopping it up. The point I'm making is that I just don't think that many people have these issues with cables. And if you do, you just go and buy another one on Amazon and it arrives 2 days later. And you can do that. You can do that 9 more times for the same price of buying one of these.
That is, I could see the other argument that, is there any point in spending $30 on a cable when you could just buy 10 regular cables and throw them away? On the other hand, right, it's only $30, for God's sake. It's not much. That's what? About 16 quid?
Yeah, but it's $30 for one. I mean, I'd need to buy one for my lightning, one for the lightning cable for my iPad. I'd need to buy one. Well, I'd need to buy multiple ones for the for micro USB. Because I've got multiple devices that use this.
What I'm
and then you may have one for an old iPad.
It seems like a very cool cable that's kind of niche, that if you need it, $30 is not a lot. If you don't need it, it's just you don't need it.
I'm not for a moment suggesting that everyone should start buying these instead of ordinary ones. But if you're the sort of person...
Is the licensing cost for Lightning $10? That seems like a big... $25 and $35 is a big difference.
But that's because Apple charge you licensing money for Lightning cables.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Is the licensing fee for a single cable $10?
I don't know.
Are they just assuming Apple people will pay more?
I don't know. I mean, if you buy a lightning cable off of Apple themselves, which doesn't have any steel sheet armoring at all, it's about 15 quid from apple.co.uk. So it's not that much cheaper than this. And this one can be chainsawed, and that one frays like a bastard. So
you know what, though, as well? Like, I don't know about you guys, but the problems I have with cables are not usually the actual cable itself. It's the connector.
And
like the amount of bent USB, the amount of bent USB, micro USB cables that I've got is like 2 or 3.
Yeah, I've had one,
because
a couple before.
I've jammed it in somewhere and it's bent at the end. It's not the actual cable. The cable itself very rarely gets, unless it gets crushed between something.
I'm not sure about that. They talk about how the actual connector is, you know, bound to the steel or properly gripped or something. But I suppose the actual bit that sticks out that goes into your phone, if you bend that, the cable can't be protected from that. At least you make it out of iridium or something.
And is that made out of titanium or whatever the cable is
made out. I don't know. They talk about the connector and the way the steel is bound to the connector itself, but I don't know how the little actual sticky out metal bit would fare if you know, drop the cable.
If the sticky out metal bit is as tough as the
rest
the snake
of the cable
that's
is
around the cable, now that would be more compelling to me because those things do bend quite
a
lot.
That's
a
good question, and I don't know the answer, and I don't want to find out, because the only way I can think of finding out is basically attempting to bend it with pliers, and it turns out that's a problem, that I've just broken my unbreakable cable, and I will be sad.
So, how's the warranty on that thing?
Right.
I'm not sure the warranty applies if they send you a review copy. I'd have to ask.
Well, I believe that you doing that is in the interest of a good review. So put bad voltage first. Two questions for you is, you said, first of all, how heavy are these things? Because they look like they'd be heavy.
They're heavier than a cable, obviously, but they're not that heavy, I don't think. It's like... I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's a solid block of iron or anything like that. So you can
feel, but I imagine it's
they're
like
slightly weightier, but only in the same way that, you know, laptop leads, if you haven't got a Mac, are quite thick. And if you've got a coiled up one of them, you can feel the weight of it. Like that.
Right. But it seems like it seems like they've basically made this out of the same tube that connects a shower head to the shower.
That's the kind of the vibe of it. Except I think it's proper steel. Yes.
But you said that they don't like, you can't wrap them up very closely, right? They don't bend very much.
Well,
right?
No, I mean, it coils up fine, but it coils up into a thing, you know, for a circle 4 inches across. You can't just, you know, with a normal cable, you could wrap it around 2 fingers quite happily if you wanted to. This, no.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like if you run over cables or you need to change all your cables, this is the one you should get then, right?
This is my thought. It's for people who would find this kind of thing useful, who find themselves thinking, I wish my cables didn't do this, it seems like a cool thing to own.
A little while ago, an organisation called the Software Freedom Conservancy, which is basically a group of people who are a group of lawyers, essentially, who do really good work in GPL enforcement and various other efforts that relate to, you know, protecting the availability of software freedom, announced that a guy called Christoph Hellwig was going to be basically taking VMware to court over GPL violations. And Christoph he's a fairly well-known and well-known guy in the kernel community. He contributes extensively to the kernel. And you may see him at conferences with a mad mohawk, drinking an awful lot of booze. He's a great guy. Anyway, so they announced this, and so the story basically broke around this, and people were questioning, you know, what are VMware doing? There's not a tremendous amount of details on this that I've seen. And it's good that the Conservancy are basically putting their weight behind it. But then apparently a little while later, the Linux Foundation pulled out of supporting the Software Freedom Conservancy, as well as, and I don't think VMware have ever supported Conservancy.
I don't believe so, no.
But VMware are basically, they are members of the Linux Foundation. So this turned into a bit of a spat where people were saying, hang on a second, Linux Foundation has pulled out because they're siding with VMware. And that's ridiculous because they're the Linux Foundation. They should be supporting the work of the of Conservancy going out there and protecting against GPL violations, blah, 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 blah. So that's basically what's happened. What do you think about this? I mean, I did some digging into this and I couldn't find a tremendous amount of data about this because it's easy to think that the Linux Foundation pulled out of supporting Conservancy because of their relationship with VMware. I don't see anything that necessarily directly makes that. Well, certainly nothing that directly makes that claim, or even indirectly would be the reason why they do that.
Would you, let me ask a slightly different question. Would you be okay with it if they did?
Would I be okay if they did?
Yeah.
No.
Well, so the Linux Foundation, at its core, it really is a trade organization that's whose purpose in the end is to lobby and do other things on behalf of its members, of which VMware is one, correct?
Yeah.
So there's obviously a potential conflict there between that aspect of their role and a kind of implied thing of their role, which is to defend Linux and the concepts behind Linux, like open source software, not violating the GPL, and so on and so forth. And you could... it's not often that those two things get thrown into conflict, and you can absolutely imagine the Linux Foundation, even if they see themselves as primarily the trade organisation and not the defend the concepts role, you can imagine they don't really want to stand up and say, but we're a trade organisation, because then no one ever trusts them again. So,
I guess the question is, imagine for a second, we don't know if this happened or not, but imagine... you know, the GPL violation lawsuit has been announced from Conservancy, and the Linux Foundation executive team sit down and they say, okay, what do we want to do about this? And they said, you know, our partnership with VMware means supporting Conservancy is problematic for us. I guess the thing I don't understand is, couldn't they just, you know, I would have thought that they could continue to support Conservancy while also being good partners to VMware and going out there and supporting VMware and their open source ambitions. I don't necessarily see why you couldn't do both.
I think you know corporate politics better than that, and if you don't, you should.
I would like to think of them as what they're doing here is putting the best possible light on it, that they're not withdrawing from support, they're trying to recuse themselves from the issue, you know, because they have a vested interest. I'm sure there are hardliners on one side, saying VMware are possibly guilty of GPL violations, so you should just stop talking to them, which is not going to happen. And equally, people, hardliners on the other side, saying VMware bring you money and business, and you should stop just hanging about with all these dirty hippies who complain about them using copyright code. But I think it ought to have been possible for them to say, look, we're trying to step away from this because we are conflicted out of it. And it's weird that they haven't said that. That
to, it would that am I wrong? To my knowledge, would they haven't said anything.
Some of the argument, surely.
Is that correct?
Hmm?
I haven't seen any word from LF about why. Well, two things. I haven't seen any word from LF about anything to do with Conservancy sponsorship. And I also haven't seen any word from them about why they would stop providing sponsorship. Well, I think it's easy for us to jump to conclusions that if the Linux Foundation have stopped supporting the Conservancy financially, the reason why they're doing it is because of VMware, but we don't know if that's the case or not.
So I think the reason people are saying they stopped supporting them is that the Linux Foundation used to be on the supporters page and now is not.
Right.
But the thing with that is there's a lot of reasons why that it could have happened, that they planned on supporting him for X amount of years and this was
exactly
just coincidence. Exactly. Or there could be a whole bunch of reasons why that could have been the case.
As a community, we are temperamentally inclined to reach for conspiracy theories whenever possible, especially when it's someone doing down free software. But that does not mean that it's necessarily the case. I think part of the thing here is that GPL violations are a bad idea, and you think VMware are historically quite a good, member of the community, and it's disappointing to see them acting like this, if in fact they are.
Well, this is a really complicated. So I tried to actually get to the root of what this case actually is. And I thought initially that it was about Linux kernel modules, which has always been a kind of contentious issue of where do you draw that line between is a loadable kernel module a derivative work or isn't it? And where's that line? And the one explanation, so others don't have to look for it, because I only found one person who could explain it in English that I understood. And it was unsurprisingly for Matthew Garrett, who is not only super smart and understands this stuff, but also is pretty good at explaining it typically. So I'm going to read something just from him, just so the listeners and myself, like I said, it really helped myself. So I think it might help listeners understand what's actually happening. So this is, not my wording or anything at all. It's all from Matthew Garrett. It says, in VMware's case, the issue is not exactly a proprietary Linux kernel module. Rather, it's that the VM kernel treats Linux itself like a Linux kernel module. So when an ESXi system boots up, VM kernel is the first part of the operating system loaded into memory. VM kernel contains several low-level operating system services, such as a process schedule, a memory allocator, and services that are typically handled by the Linux kernel on a Linux-based system. So once it is actually loaded, VM kernel loads VMK Linux, which is a subset of the Linux kernel containing other important kernel services, including the SCSI subsystem and the RADx tree implementation, which is where Christoph's code is found. VM kernel also loads some proprietary VMware Linux kernel modules, while VMK Linux loads GPL licensed Linux kernel modules produced by the Linux kernel project. So that's where the line is, which is I thought.
What's odd, though, is that if you look at the, because I looked into it as well, and if you look at the frequently asked questions thing, the frequently asked questions list, what it says here is that in October 2011, Conservancy received a GPL violation report on BusyBox for VMware's ESXi products. Conservancy opened the matter in its usual friendly and non-confrontational way. Nevertheless, VMware immediately referred Conservancy to VMware's outside legal counsel in the USA, and Conservancy negotiated with VMware's legal counsel throughout late 2011, 2012 and 2013. We exchanged and reviewed CCS candidates, whatever that is. And admittedly, VMware made substantial and good efforts towards compliance in BusyBox. However, VMware still refused to fix a few minor and one major compliance problem that we discovered during the process.
So the issue Matthew Garrett explaining, I believe, is the major issue discovered during the process.
So here it says, so it sounds like there's some minor issues with BusyBox. Yeah, it says here, namely there was a major violation regarding Linux itself that ultimately became Christoph's key complaint. Yeah, you're right. That's the key complaint.
Yeah.
And it's not just one thing then.
The BusyBox thing seems to be pretty common across projects, and they're slowly cleaning that stuff up.
Yeah, and BusyBox has historically been one of the things that the Conservancy and the GPL violations team use as a lever, because lots and lots of people use it. So they go to them and say, look, you're using BusyBox, that's GPL, you have to release the code, and you're not doing so, go ahead and do it. So it was quite well understood, I think, by them, how to approach a case around BusyBox. Because they've done quite a lot.
I should also say, in the interest of full disclosure, because I think that's what you're supposed to do when you talk about things like this, is that I'm a Conservancy supporter, so I give them money every year. And I'm also friends with Jim Zemlin from the Linux Foundation. So I guess you could say that I'm biased in both directions.
Oh.
I'm not sure if that counts the bias out.
That's slightly disappointing. I thought you were going to say something like, yeah, because GitHub are massively GPL violators or something like that, but no.
Oh, yeah, that's what we're into. That's what we do. Never mind this code hosting nonsense. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is one of those difficult things whereby if the Linux Foundation pulled out of financially sponsoring Conservancy because of this, we'd never know about that. But also, because we don't have that information, people do jump to conclusions. And I think, you know, Jeremy, you mentioned earlier on about you know, politics, corporate politics. Look, the Conservancy and the Apache Foundation and the Linux Foundation and the Eclipse Foundation, they're all in the same game. They're doing it in different ways. So there is going to be an element of competition here. Just because these are foundations doesn't necessarily mean they're not competing with each other as well.
I do not think they're in the same game.
Well, they're in similar games.
Barely in the same sport.
They're absolutely in similar games.
I do not agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it varies between... Like, I think Conservancy is probably the most unusual of those. But, I mean, look at... What does Linux Foundation do? They get out there and they provide foundations in which people can bring projects in. That's what the Apache Foundation is doing. That's what the Eclipse Foundation is doing.
They I would agree that those are similar. The Conservancy, yeah. I don't think is remotely
Well, that's what I say. Like, I think Conservancy is kind of the most unusual of that group.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what do you think is going to happen with this? What do you think is going to be the conclusion of this overall thing?
But two different questions to be asked there. What's going to happen with the potential GPL violations case against VMware? And what's going to happen with the Linux Foundation and their stance on this? It's entirely possible that this stuff happened and completely independently of that, LF said, we're going to stop supporting the Conservancy this year, possibly because they've been doing it for 3 years and that's all the budget they'd allocated, or possibly because they wanted to go with someone else or whatever, doesn't matter. And the two things are not related at all and it's just pure coincidence. If so, it is spectacularly ill-timed from a PR point of view. But it feels to me like if that was the case, that they would say... Oh man, seriously, it's genuinely a total coincidence. We didn't think of it that way. These are the reasons why we stopped. And they haven't said anything. It feels slightly weird to me that they haven't said anything. Yeah. There's been no clarifying statement at all, which feels...
It does, yeah.
Almost always, if there's no clarifying statement at all, it's not because there's a clear, obvious, good answer that everyone like and you just haven't got round to writing it down.
Yes, nearly never.
Well, yeah, and you're right. And then maybe... There's almost certainly going to be a ton of behind-the-scenes stuff going on here that we have absolutely no idea about in these kinds of situations. So, who knows? There may be some kind of legal implications. I don't know. But I think that what we're seeing here is only part of the picture.
That's usually the case. And I guess the other question here, too, because Eck had two questions, is how will the SFC come out of this? Will they be able to changing their funding model from corporate sponsors to individual sponsors, which honestly probably fits their model better anyway, considering what they do? I think corporate sponsorship was always going to be a little bit contentious. Whether they'll, I think they set two levels of funding, and they already hit the lower level, which means they'll, quote unquote, just sustain the organization for a bare minimum service plan. So that's at least they are going to continue to exist. The higher level was whether they were continue doing copyleft enforcement or not, and I don't know if they've hit that goal yet.
Yes, certainly.
The
individual model, as you say, individual thing, not getting corporate sponsorship, certainly fits their ethos better because it completely removes the possibility of this kind of conflict of interest. But
correct.
They've also written quite a bit of stuff that I've read about how, you know, we're going to have to cut a bunch of the stuff that we do if we don't get the funding. And individual funding, it just doesn't work very well. You know, people talk a good game about it, but in practice, there aren't that many organisations doing good things which are individually funded by people. I mean, most charities are funded the same way and they haven't got any money either.
Yeah, and this is one of those things whereby... part of the reason why I give them money as well as the FSF and the EFF, and part of the reason why I give Conservancy money and the FSF money is because even though, frankly, there's, I mean, Brad Kuhn specifically at the Software Freedom Conservancy, him and I have had many a spirited debate about topics, and we don't see eye to eye on them. But in my mind, that's irrelevant because I think the overall body of the work that they do is really important. Like the GPL violation, I don't know, I think hardly anyone else does GPL violation stuff.
No, they've been the predominant. It almost seems to me like they should split into two organizations because their GPL compliance stuff is important, and the other side of what they do, which is allowing smaller projects. So Linux Foundation and Apache are, in my mind, for very large projects with a very large scope to come under the umbrella and not have to worry about administration and what's really involved with the 501(c) and all that stuff, where what SFC was doing were smaller projects could come on board and not have to worry about that kind of stuff. And I think that's a really, really important, really underserved component of the open source community. So if the GPL compliance ends up bringing down the organization and that piece goes missing, I really think that would be a travesty. So I think it almost makes sense to split them up and fund them differently because on the one side, I think corporate sponsorship would make a lot of sense, where on the GPN's compliance side, I think the user funding would make a lot of sense.
That's actually a good thought.
And I don't know how you mix those. I don't know why they ever were mixed into the same organization. SFC really changed their scope kind of midway through their existence in a way that I don't think suited them very well. They should have broke that off into a separate, whether it was a subsidiary, a completely separate organization with the same board, I don't know, but. And that wraps up the very last show of 2015.
Yes. Yeah. Good show.
Yeah.
Does indeed. Show.
It was a
long one.
Have you had a fun year?
Guess it's what?
Chaps.
I have had an outstanding year. How about you?
Yeah. Very good. Very good.
Apart from Steam Machines not being successful and 4K TVs not being successful and Chromos not being successful.
It was a very exciting year for Bad Voltage. We did two live shows.
Yeah.
Could be better than that. A third one coming up very soon, in fact.
Yes,
Ring 2016 incorrectly.
Yeah, it's going to be on the 22nd of January in 2016 in Pasadena, which is a bit of Los Angeles in America. As part of the Scale conference, we're going to be doing our live show. Couple of details for you folks. So this show is going to be basically the four of us all together on stage doing a show in front of an audience. And we've done it a couple of times before. It's been an absolute blast both times. If you want to go and check it out, go to the Bad Voltage YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/badvoltage. You can check out the videos. Similar kind of deal. We're going to have some fun surprises. We're going to have some free beer there. There's going to be some prizes available in the show as well. So you got to get along. It's going to be an absolute blast.
Absolutely.
Couple of things to note. The show is completely free to attend. So if you're just going to be around the LA area, or if you're flying in there, you don't want to go to Scale, you can just show up and go to the Bad Voltage show. Doors are going to open at about 7:30. There's an event called Upscale that's on just before we go on. So if you show up and there's a bunch of lightning talks going on, then don't be surprised. That's basically Upscale.
Yeah, but more importantly...
But we do encourage you to go to Scale,
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Go to Scale itself. It's an excellent thing on 4 days. Yeah. It's really good conference. You'll enjoy it. UbuCon is part of it, the Ubuntu in-person conference. And you can get a bunch of money off the price of a ticket by using the code BVOLT when you buy a ticket.
Yes.
Yeah. And Brian, if he was here right now, he'd be self-promoting himself as usual.
He would.
So it would be remiss for us not to mention that Brian's going to be doing his Linux Sucks talk. I think it's Linux Sucks on the Thursday night as well.
Yep.
So but the Bad Voltage show is on Friday, the 22nd of January, which is obviously the Friday night. But if you do get in there earlier on the Thursday, you can see Brian do his thing, which is always fun on the Thursday night. And during the day on Thursday, there's a bunch of other little conferences. Like Ak mentioned, there's going to be the UbuCon and there's going to be Mark Shuttleworth is going to be speaking there and a bunch of other people. It's going to be a blast. And Scale itself is mainly Saturday and Sunday. And it's just, anyone who's heard this show before knows how much we love that show and the people who run it. So go and check it out. You can get some free beer, a fun Bad Voltage show, some prizes. It's going to be an absolute rocking show.
And I know we're not doing the predictions until next show, but I have an early prediction. This Live Voltage is going to be the best Live Voltage we've done to date. I'm going to... I'm going to put that out there right now.
I would endorse that prediction. Yes, absolutely. Although,
yeah, I agree as well.
I'm now worried that given our spectacular lack of prediction success, maybe that's the kiss of death that we've just put on.
Oh, that's a good point. That might not have been a good thing to say.
It's going to suck. Fair point. Yes. So ignore what Jeremy said. What else do we have? Do we have something from Ken Fallon?
I think we do.
Ah, yes. Yes, no, that's a good point. Ken Fallon dropped us a note to say, language, you suck at websites, which is not wholly incorrect. One of the things he asked for was a full feed for the podcast. At the moment, if you subscribe to the podcast RSS feed or iTunes or whatever, you only get the latest 10 episodes. That's a deliberate decision, because otherwise someone new to the show comes along and says, oh, I quite like this Bad Vultures thing, sticks it in their podcast feed reader, and then it downloads 57 episodes of the show and they get really cross with us. Yes. I can change...
The 10 episodes is a pretty standard thing.
Yeah, this is... an awful lot of that kind of thinking is superstition on my part, basically. In practice, podcast feed readers these days tend not to do that and are a bit more sensible. But I got burned an awful lot by this years ago when doing Lug Radio, about how spectacularly badly implemented podcast listing software was. So if people think that it would be fine to add all the episodes to the feed or to set up a separate feed for the show, I know a couple of people have asked in the past, I'd be interested to hear other people's thoughts, which you can drop by on community.badvoltage.org, which is our forum. Give me some thoughts on whether you'd like to see that, whether you'd find it useful, why you think it would be a bad idea, what might break, so on and so forth. He does also point out a couple of other website issues about how it would be nice if the dates actually were dates rather than just times. And he's not wrong, and I'll fix it at some point. Don't worry. It's just things like, you know,
the scheme of things.
You know, episode 41 or whatever will say, posted by Stuart Langridge at 9:29 p.m. Not what day it was posted, just the time, which is, I grant you, not that useful. And I hadn't
noticed.
That's
actually not even correct, though. If you look at the shows, the last show says posted by Stuart Langridge on 17th December 2015.
Oh, goodness, maybe I fixed it by accident at some point then.
Okay.
Hooray for me! I'm that efficient, but I've done it already. But yeah, I will take a look at that. One of the things I'd like to do is poke the website a bit, because the formatting's still not great and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it does need a little updating.
Yeah, so it needs a boot to shape up, and it will get that at some point when I get my head above water.
Yeah. Well, I guess we will kiss goodbye to 2015. It's been a great year, with full of incorrect predictions. as Jeremy said, a couple of live voltage performances from us, and we're looking forward to another year of Bad Voltage next year. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yep, absolutely.
This would be quite boring if no one checked it out. Good. So,
Brian, get over
to community.badvoltage.org.
We should say,
get well soon.
Yeah, get well soon, Brian. Yep. Hope you're okay.
And for those of you listening, we'll have a very happy new year.